For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to All My Best Friends Are Digital, a podcast about video games and the stories they tell. With me is my dear friend, Caitlin. How are you doing, Caitlin?
I am wonderful. How about you, Mark?
I'm doing very well. I unfortunately didn't have a whole lot of time to devote to video games this week. Partially, this is your fault, because what happened was I needed something on in the background while I was doing some hardware modifications to one of my handhelds, specifically my Pimax Portal. I was swapping out the joysticks for Gullikit Hall sticks. Not that the Hall effect is super important. It's overrated, but that's a huge other thing to get into. And I wanted to put something on in the background, and I just finished re-listening to our episode where we talked about Red Dead Redemption, in which you acknowledged that you had not seen Midnight Mass.
Yes.
So I'm like, oh, I'll put Midnight Mass on in the background. One does not put Midnight Mass on in the background.
Okay.
So I had to rewatch all of it, naturally.
Naturally.
So, Caitlin, have you, since that discussion, seen Midnight Mass?
No, not yet.
Okay, well...
All of my TV time has been Severance lately, but I will get to it, I promise.
Okay, that's legitimate, but what I want to do, I would never in a million years sick an internet mob onto anybody, much less you, Caitlin. But I'm just saying that if there's what I will classify as audience inscription energy, which I identify as specifically the energy to constantly ping and check to see if we've made any progress on something, okay, which most recently for both of us in various forms was checking in about Inscription. If anybody has any sort of that latent energy around and needs to channel it somewhere, I think it ought to be channeled towards Caitlin watching Midnight Mass. How's that?
Okay, understood.
Having done that terrible thing, we're going to be talking about video games. We're going to be talking about what we've been playing lately. We're going to be talking about Astyanax, the Nintendo Entertainment System game in our retro segment, Goof. We're going to proceed on to our main game, which is The Friends of Ringo Ishikawa. And then we're going to close it out with some shameless hyping of upcoming titles in Shout. So, Caitlin, what have you been up to lately other than watching Severance?
So, I had a business trip this week. So, my gaming was a little bit more limited than normal. But I bookended my week with Avowed, because I desperately tried to beat it before I had to leave. And then I couldn't. And then I ended up beating it just yesterday after I got back from my trip. And then during the week, I played some Final Fantasy IV, because that's the next one on my Final Fantasy quote book club, unquote.
That is indeed the next one. Having finished 3, 4, the logic is inescapable.
It is. And it's like the first like good one, in my opinion. So, and I probably a lot of people's opinion. I don't know. So anyway, I'm enjoying it very much so far. I'm not particularly far through it, maybe a couple hours, but I'm really excited to see how it holds up because I have confidence that it holds up.
And once again, you're playing the pixel remaster versions of these things, yes?
Yes, yep.
And Final Fantasy IV is the one that was published in North America as Final Fantasy II.
Correct.
All right, so the first Super Nintendo one, and by broad accounts, the first one that actually attempted to tell something what we might call a modern-looking story.
Yeah.
With named characters and motivations and such.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, we have, like, actual characters. They have opinions about things. It's great.
So, Kane.
Yes. one of my many former childhood crushes.
Really?
Yes. I don't even think you ever see his face. He just had a cool dragon helmet, and I just thought that was great.
oh, there are cool things about Kane. His personality is not among them, I don't think.
No, it's really not.
There's this dynamic in a lot of popular culture that's deeply unfortunate and not a small amount misogynistic. I would actually analogize it to the other dynamic. So there's Rosa, right, who's the main character's love interest.
Yes.
Whose name is Cecil, the main character.
Yes.
And then there's Kane. It's kind of like the same dynamic with respect to Cyclops, Jean Grey, and Wolverine, right? Where there's the third character who demonstrates his deep tragic love for the female lead by being an unrelenting douchebag.
Yeah.
Is this an accurate recollection of how Kane acts? Because I haven't played Final Fantasy... Well, I played Final Fantasy II roughly when it came out and never since.
Yeah, so that's also the last time I played Final Fantasy II. So at this point, I have not yet gotten to a place where Kane does anything other than follow the main character around.
Okay.
So Rosa has not yet joined the party. I believe she's supposed to do it after my next section, but I will update you on that next week, perhaps.
Okay, the world is waiting with bated breath.
Yes.
But you are enjoying this significantly more than you did 1, 2, and 3, right?
I am, yeah. Just like having interesting things happen. Very early on in the game, in Final Fantasy IV, Cecil
learns
that his, you know, maybe his kingdom isn't so great because they just tried to obliterate a bunch of, you know, a whole village full of summoners. And they
tried
wanna...
to. I think they did a darn good job of it, as I recall.
Yeah, they really did. There's only one survivor. Her name is Rydia. And, you know, Cecil decides to protect her rather than murder her like his king wants. So,
as I recall, and this would be a spoiler if it happened later, but this is literally the first thing that happens in the game.
Yeah.
They kind of cop out on the whole village slaughtering thing, because as I recall, what happens is they show up in their airships and they're just told to open up some boxes, and then monsters start spilling out and the monsters slaughter everybody. Am I misremembering?
What happens is that Cecil, he captures one of the crystals for the king. And by doing that, it looks like he kind of kills a bunch of, like, quote, innocent, I don't know, we don't really know them, black mages and white mages who are trying to protect it. It turns out they're probably not dead because you see them in jail later. But anyway, he steals the crystal and then he expresses some doubts toward the king. And the king's like, oh, you want to express doubts? Well, you're fired. Or demoted. He's not fired. He's demoted. It's like, and
oh,
you know,
I remember that.
Yeah. And then he's like, okay, you need to go to this village. And by the way, take this bomb ring with you for some reason. So he does. And then when you and Kane walk in, the bomb ring automatically activates and a bunch of bomb enemies come out and set the whole village on fire and almost everybody dies.
I remember thinking at the time that the response was disproportionate to Cecil's, like, because Cecil just asks a couple of questions, doesn't he?
Yes. He's like, hey, do we need to be, you know, just like very low level, like light doubts as to the king's motivations and what he's trying to do. And the king's like, oh, like, I won't stand for this. So
I think I remember as you know, a relatively young video gamer going through this and be like, that's a strong reaction.
Yeah.
It'd be one thing if Cecil shows up and it's like, look, you know, Your Majesty, I've decided that what you've done is a bad idea. But he's mostly just asking about the contours of his orders. And vibe I got was that the king could have very easily been like, it's not your position to question. This is just how things are going to be. And Cecil might have shrugged and gone on with his day.
Yeah.
Murdering people. But no, instead, it's something along the lines of Cecil being like, I don't feel super awesome about the things that have gone on. It's like, well, I guess I better murder all of you.
Yeah. Yeah. It didn't go over well.
I don't know that any head of government would be so irrational in terms of demanding loyalty from his subordinates, would you?
No, no idea. I don't know anyone like that.
No, that sounds implausible. Well, anyway, moving on. So I'm glad you're enjoying Final Fantasy IV/Final Fantasy II.
Yes.
I confess I've been vaguely curious about maybe going back, but mostly as I've expressed before on the show, I was tired of JRPGs by the end of Final Fantasy II. And it was the first one I played. So I don't know that I'm super keen to go back to it. But I do remember the story being more interesting than even many of its successors.
Yeah.
maybe this is just another reminder that I desperately need to play Chrono Trigger because everyone tells me that you don't even really need to grind too much in it. So
yeah, I can't remember, honestly, because it's been so long, but I played that game to death because I wanted to, and I thought it was fun.
Right.
And yeah, so very good.
Well, and it probably doesn't have Kane in it, so that's definitely
an advantage. It does not. There is no Kane, so.
All right,
it's good to know. What have you been playing?
I played a demo of a game that was kind of recommended to me by virtue of its structure. I was told that it was a roguelite mech game with customization elements. I'm like, all right, sign me up. It is called Metalbringer. I did not play the retail version. I've only played the demo, and the demo gave me a few hours to tinker around with it, and I have come away mostly disappointed, frankly. The structure is such that you've got this two levels of robot, and they don't do a very good job of explaining it because you have these labors, and there's a very famous anime series called Pat Labor, and labor is the term they're used for giant robots. These are not giant robots. Labors are the small robots, the sort of android avatars that you send out into the world. They then pilot giant robots, which are called arms. And okay. If you're telling me that there are small robots and giant robots, one called labors and one called arms, I would have put them the other way around. So, frankly, this is more of a me thing, but I spent much of the early game confused as to what I was doing and when. It's like, okay, well, now you go and customize your labor. It's like, okay. And then there are these arms over here. It's like, that looks like a giant war machine. Okay, fine. So, this two-level of robot is echoed in the two levels of combat. You might be fighting things as a labor, you might be fighting things as an arm. And unfortunately, in both levels, I don't find the combat very satisfying. It's all very... The term I would use, this is a term from fighting games, and it's never used positively. It's all kind of floaty in the sense that things don't feel like they have impact. Feels don't... When you shoot something, when you hit something, when you charge at something, when you smack something with a melee weapon, it doesn't feel either satisfying or clear. And so, consequently, as a user, I feel sufficiently far removed from what's going on, and it's unsatisfying. So you have all these waves of enemies. It superficially looks rather a lot like a Bullet Heaven game, in that there's a large number of relatively feeble enemies that just start marching towards you slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, the things that you do are kind of slow and muddy as well. I had a bad premonition when the first thing that happened after I got launched from the starting area, and I started... The first thing I did was I deployed a ranged attack using the starting pistol, and the rate of fire was glacial. I'm like, oh, it's going to be one of those games.
Oh.
Yeah, it's just a bad sign. I'm not insisting that something always have a high rate of fire. You can have satisfying low rate of fire things. But when I have the highest rate of fire starting weapon, and it feels like I'm on an infinite cooldown, and the projectiles travel very slowly, and then when they hit, I can only dimly register that they've done any damage. This is all a series of bad UI indications and bad pacing indications. On top of that, when you get into an arm, and if you have lots and lots of other enemies, because you go through a sort of tutorial mission where other arms beat the crap out of each other and leap behind a whole bunch of parts. This is where the customization comes in. And so you have very, very high level weapons for your first kind of tutorial mission. Even then, the weapons didn't feel very satisfying. Nothing I did felt very good. I would wade into a mass of enemies, swinging around some sort of laser halberd, and I couldn't tell who was taking damage. This wasn't even a question of visual chaos. It's not because there was too much going on the screen. Like, when you're playing a Survivors-type game, whether it's Vampire Survivor or Karate Survivors or whatever, I often have a little bit of difficulty differentiating who's doing what and when, but I generally have a pretty good sense about basic things like, am I being hit?
Yes. You know?
I don't have the precise feedback of, oh, this zombie is taking 10 damage from this weapon and 5 damage from this. No. There's far too many numbers flying around the screen for that. But I generally know whether I'm being hit. Playing Metalbringer, I never could. I would wade into a bunch of enemies, swing around a whole bunch of melee attacks. Things would happen. There'd be a mess of movement, not nearly quickly or satisfyingly enough, but then I wouldn't know who was taking damage.
Hmm.
And this was true whether I was fighting peons. This is true whether I was fighting bigger arms. And it was just led me not to want to engage in the core mechanisms of the game. On top of it being muddy and unsatisfying, I also found it pretty visually hideous. So it uses voxel-style graphics.
Okay.
And let me be very clear. I like old-style graphics. Not even in a sort of nostalgia way. I just genuinely appreciate the aesthetic. I play 40, sometimes even 50-year-old games in high def. and like the chunky pixel nature of it. I've been playing Tekken 5 recently, and I was looking at I was shown a video of like Heihachi Mishima, his model evolving. I looked at his Tekken 2 model with all those crispy polygons. I said, oh, that looks kind of cool. And I appreciate some of these older things, but for what it's worth, voxel graphics, whether they were cutting edge at the time, we talked about this in the context of Wing Commander Privateer and how ugly it was, or whether it's modern iterations of voxel graphics, they often seem to me like the worst of all possible worlds. You get the muddy and indistinctness of your low-res sprites, coupled with the sort of indistinct chunkiness of your early polygon efforts. And it just makes this mud of disgusting, ugly, generic stuff going on.
Yeah, I've always felt the same way about voxel graphics. They probably could be pulled off in a good way, but I don't know that I've seen it yet.
I would be very curious if anyone has seen voxel graphics done well, either at the time or now, or more recent, you know, pre or post high def, I guess would be the big demarcation point. By all means, I'd be curious to see it. But I, like you, have never seen it executed particularly well. And Metalbringer is very much par for the course. If you like voxel-style graphics, Metalbringer may appeal to you more. And maybe some of my sense that the gameplay was muddy and unsatisfying was informed by my inability to appreciate the voxel mess that was going on in front of me. But I like pixels, I like chunky polygons, but I do not like voxels. And so I didn't like it visually, I didn't like the gameplay experience, and just to cap it all off, the fact that I persisted past this, I deserve some kind of medal. So after you do the sort of vaguely tutorial mission where you're given high-spec objects and weapons, you go and start the core gameplay loop. And obviously the fact that it's a roguelite lends itself very well because, you know, you're remote piloting an android who in turn is remote piloting a mech. Labors and arms in the parlance of the game, of course.
Mm-hmm.
When you start the game for real, you have the same parts available to you when you're making a little android, which basically means you get to choose from some intro weapons. I immediately switched from the intro pistol to an intro bazooka because if I'm going to be feeling like it's slow and cumbersome anyway, I might as well blow something up at the end of it.
Yeah.
But instead of a starter mech with starter mech weapons and starter mech parts, you get industrial equipment, like a forklift.
Oh.
And let me tell you, I thought that cutting-edge particle beam and laser halberds felt muddy and unsatisfying. Charging into a group of enemies on a forklift? Oh my goodness, it felt terrible. I hated that part. And I didn't even really know it was hard to get to a part where I could get blueprints for better stuff. Because most of the time you get blueprints for better stuff by beating mechs. And let me tell you how the military mechs were unimpressed with my construction machines in the early parts. So it was, on top of being unsatisfying and being difficult, it was also desperately uncool. Like, it's just, look, I'm here to play a mech game. Come on.
Yeah.
You can give me a garbage entry-level mech. Armored Core has been doing this for decades. Those early mechs are garbage. They still look great, and they still fun to maneuver and play around with. Even if you're outnumbered and outgunned, you don't have to make them weak sauce and stupid looking. Like, even in the context of the game engine, they were stupid looking. And it just was not to my taste. So unfortunately, Metalbringer was a miss for me. A lot of people really seem to like it. And as I say, roguelite mech games, there's a lot to like in that basic structure. But I think they dropped the ball, both in terms of the visuals and in terms of the starting progression, but mostly in terms of how unsatisfying it was to do anything by virtue of how muddy and indistinct everything felt. It felt sluggish, and therefore I felt as remote from the action as a remote person projecting their consciousness into a remote android.
Oh.
So that's okay. How you bring it all together, Caitlin. That's some professional class wordplay. That's a theme. That's a leitmotif brought together.
It was beautiful.
Thanks, Caitlin. I appreciate that.
You mentioned the very beginning, kind of like the tutorial level, you actually do get to fight with some real mechs, right?
Yes. Yeah, okay. You're basically given a whole bunch of parts that you're not able to select from at the start of the game. And when that run concludes, there's a boss that I'm sure if you're really, really good, you might be able to beat, or maybe the game will force you to lose at some point. I felt like it was the end, now you lose part of the intro mission, but I could have been mistaken. But you don't have the blueprints for those parts, so you're not able to start with those parts again. They're gone. And so it's just the first mission throws at you a whole bunch of good salvage.
I see. Okay. And then you're left with a forklift.
Then you're left with a forklift, exactly.
Is it literally a forklift?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. I thought so, but I was like, well, maybe it just looks... No. Okay. All right.
No, I am not being disparaging about the mech design of the early mech parts that you have access to. It is literally a forklift.
Okay. That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I have a hard time thinking, like, who says, all right, I'm going to jump in this forklift, and I am going to go to battle against real mechs.
You'd be surprised. It's not the first time I've seen this. This is a bit of a reach, but a while ago, so a couple decades ago, there was a collectible miniatures game based on the Battletech universe. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much familiarity you have with it, but you've probably heard of the Battletech universe.
Heard of it,
in some context. Yeah, because they're the Mech Warrior PC games, and they've been pretty popular. And it's one of the most iconic series of mech games in the American aesthetic of mech. And when this collectible miniatures game, they got the license to the name, and they got the license to the universe, but they didn't get the license to the actual mech designs.
What?
And so consequently, they came up with this whole side story thing about how this was a vaguely post-apocalyptic and technology was even harder to get hands on. And so they made all these new designs, fine, whatever, and a whole bunch of them, a large proportion of them, were basically reclaimed agricultural or industrial materials. And so they looked like adapted industrial machinery, and they were terrible, and nobody wanted to play with them.
Okay, I was just going to ask, like, was it fun? No. Okay. Got it.
It is not hard to make people like me be enthusiastic about your giant stompy robots.
Yeah.
Lean in to the giant stompy robot. Don't make me think that instead of piloting a giant stompy robot, I'm restocking shelves at Costco. I've got nothing against restocking shelves at Costco. Literally, some of my closest friends restock shelves at Costco. But I don't think when they think of high-octane mecha action, they think of their jobs restocking shelves at Costco.
Probably not.
That's Metalbringer.
All right. So now we can move on to our gaming opinions on old school funware segment, which we call Goof, where we are going to talk about Astyanax. Did I say it right?
I think so. I'm not 100% sure. Are you familiar with the mythological reference that Astyanax is making?
So I know it's a Greek mythology thing, which in fact the character actually says in the very beginning of the NES version, not the arcade version. But I don't know specifics at all.
Astyanax was the son of Hector, effectively the grandson of Priam, the king of Troy. Troy did not end well, as you might know from the Iliad. There are many stories about how Astyanax died as a baby, the most gruesome of which is that he was used to bludgeon his grandfather to death.
Oh my god.
Yeah, no, real bad. Now, there are some versions where he survives the fall of Troy.
Okay.
These are in the minority. Mostly what happens to Astyanax, the mythological character, is he is killed by the Greeks as a baby.
Okay, so his parents really liked him to name this guy Astyanax.
I don't know how much they knew, they being the fictional parents of Astyanax, or they being the game developers of Astyanax, because the original arcade game has next to nothing to do with the NES game.
Yeah.
And the main character isn't even named Astyanax. The main character is named Roche, or Rocha, or Roque, I don't know. And it's just, it's a whole thing. It's a scene and a half. But we're primarily talking about the NES version, which is not really an adaptation. It's kind of its own thing. And this, too, is a fixture of your childhood, if I'm not mistaken.
It is, yes. So I only learned last week that there was an arcade version, which is called The Astyanax, apparently.
It is called The Astyanax. In Japan, it was called Lord of King.
So in the NES version of Astyanax, you play a 16-year-old boy, and his parents, I guess, don't like him and are into Greek mythology. And he's transported to another world by the fairy Cutie, who summoned him to help save Princess Rosebud from the evil Blackhorn.
No, you don't get to breeze past those names. The fairy's name is Cutie.
Cutie.
And he is supposed to rescue the Princess Rosebud. Now,
Rosebud.
This is an this is like an OG isekai, right?
Yes.
You can't swing a dead Troy noble without hitting isekai all over the place now. It is so omnipresent and insufferable for what it's worth. I think it's overdone, like mad. But whatever, trends are trends, they're going to trend. And I don't hit all isekai. In fact, there was an isekai done in the 90s called Escaflowne that I quite like. But setting all that aside, this is an isekai before it was a thing, released in 1989 in Japan. So you do not get to tar Asti Annex with the reborn as a villainous brush, as it were. And what's striking, you know, you talk about how he's brought into another world to save Princess Rosebud via the fairy cutie. Normally, yes. This is what you'd get in the blurb at the front of the manual or in the back of the box.
Yeah.
This is, by the standards of 8-bit generation, this is like Metal Gear Solid levels of storytelling. I'm not exaggerating. There's like extensive, reasonably well-written. It's not Shakespeare, but like, look, it's the grammar is correct for the most part. Mm-hmm. There's only a couple minor misspellings here and there, but there's like considerable cutscene action going on here. It's wild.
I know, cutscenes in an NES game, like, it is wild. Yeah, I was thinking exactly the same thing. So yeah, you're summoned to this other world, and you're like, oh, I don't actually want to do this, but oops, cutie doesn't have the power to send you back. So you have to rescue Rosebud because she's the only one who can send you home.
I genuinely appreciated that. Like, his response, he's a 16-year-old kid, right? He's shown in his, like, school clothes. He's got, like, some sort of weird t-shirt with the shirt with sleeves rolled up or something. I couldn't tell if he was supposed to be a greaser or what. Whatever. It's fine. He shows up and Cutie's like, okay, I brought you here to rescue the princess. And Astiatic's response basically is, I don't care. Not my problem. Would you mind sending me back? I have a curfew, more or less.
Yeah.
And Cutie's like, oopsie, I kind of ran out of power, so you're on the hook. He's like, oh, okay, fine.
Yep.
Again, it's not great, but by the standards of 8-bit storytelling, this is great. This is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And what follows is a side-scrolling, vaguely platformy action thingy. What are your thoughts on the overall gameplay of Asti Annex, looking back on it now?
So I muttered to myself multiple times while playing, oh, I hate this game. And I don't hate it, but some of the enemies are horrible. The fact that when you get hit, you get knocked back a little bit, and that often will just end up pushing you into a chasm and you die and you have to start the level over.
I believe when talking about past Castlevanias in particular, I tried to make reference to this precise phenomena, and Asti Annex does it in spades.
Yeah.
Actually, it kind of lulled me into a false sense of security, because in level one, there are these flying enemies, and I'm like, oh great, here we go. But they're not actually all that bad. They're not too bad. This is not like the small flying bird that is going to take all your life points problem.
Yes.
Asti Annex leans into a slightly different problem prevalent in the 8-bit era. Mega Man used to pull this crap all the time. I'm going to call it the platform spawn. This is the thing where you're jumping between pillars, and the moment you get to the edge of one pillar, it starts a brief countdown so that it guarantees that while you're in the air, an enemy will spawn to hit you to cause you to then fall into the chasm and lose a life.
Yep.
And so what you have to do, this is calling back to our discussion last week about pacing and speed, what you have to do is you can't just jump from platform to platform. You have to go to the edge of a platform and then wait a tick to see if anything's spawning. So you never even get any satisfying momentum going. You always just get the start-stop nonsense so you don't fall to your death.
Yep. And we've also got like a power bar. So, you know, if you wait a while and you attack, then you get your full power attack. Otherwise, you get like a weak attack. I do think that even the weakest attacks probably do a little bit more damage than they did in Secret of Evermore, but it's still very much the same thing. Like, the number of times, like, there was one boss in particular where I would have to do a full power hit to hit the boss once, and that was just to destroy something that would allow me to get to the thing that actually deals damage to the boss. But I don't have time for the full charge thing to go and be able to hit it before the first part respawns, so that was very annoying.
I'm not going to defend the stamina bar per se. It was less obnoxious than most other stamina bars.
I do agree with that.
Like, Illusion of Mana is, or was it Legend of Mana? I can't even remember the names of these things anymore.
Secret of Mana? Secret of Evermore?
Oh, geez. I made fun of the title at the time. It's not as bad as the most egregious of stamina bars. And furthermore, it does play into something that I think is kind of mechanically interesting. Namely, that there are three different weapons you have. Now, the instruction manual has a misprint and just botches the information entirely.
Oh my god, does it?
Yeah. The long and the short of it is, you start with an axe, which is really bad at magic and not too bad at attack power. You can upgrade to a spear, which gets weaker in attack power but better at magic. And then you can go all the way to a sword, which is weaker at magic but the strongest in attack power. And that determines both the overall length of your stamina gauge and how quickly it fills up. And so I kind of like that difference, especially given how potent magic is and the fact that you can swap between different kinds of magic. The only issue I had, and this is classic 8-bit nonsense, if this were a more modern game, you'd be able to switch back and forth between the weapons under some kind of condition. But because this is more primitive game design, all you have are power-ups, which progress you towards the quote-unquote next weapon. So from axe to spear to sword. There are reasons to prefer the spear over the sword, but you're just going to keep upgrading past them.
Yeah.
Like, shoot-em-ups didn't do this. Shoot-em-ups would have different kinds of weapons. You could swap between them by picking up power-ups, and you could just avoid picking up the one you didn't want. Whereas in Astyanax, they kind of present it as though this powers up your weapon. Well, not really. It just changes your weapon. Maybe you're happy with what you want. There are reasons to prefer the axe over the spear, frankly. And I do wish that it had leaned a little bit better into that difference between the weapons.
Yeah, because so when you... If you die during a level, then I know that your weapon will get set back one tier. So if you die when you have a sword, you'll get set back to the spear. By the way, the spear, I don't know why I thought this. No, I absolutely know why I thought this. I thought it was a violin, and I was like, why are we attacking with like a violin?
It does look very stupid looking, yes.
Pretty string instrumenty. So I did not realize. Okay, I looked at the manual after the fact. So after
you did,
I did look at it, but it was after this, I'd already finished.
This, Caitlin, Astyanax is what took this.
Well, I looked because I knew I could remember that there were other spells, but I couldn't figure out how to change off the fire spell. And actually, oh, okay. I still don't know how because I didn't see that described in the. In the book. It was under the start menu. So do you have to pause to be able to change your spell? Okay.
Yeah, it's under the pause menu. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't end up actually ever changing my spell. I was always using the fire one, which is fine.
Well, the fire spell is pretty good, so that's fine.
Yeah, when I read what the other ones do, so you have the fire spell, you have the lightning spell, which uses the most mana, and I don't actually know what that one does, and you have a freeze spell that just stops enemies' time, I guess, so you can just hit them.
The lightning spell hits everything on screen, whereas the fire spell just initiates a 360-degree damaging effect emanating from the main character. So, frankly, I do not see much reason to switch to the lightning spell. The fire spell will do just fine.
Yeah, use more mana to basically get the same effect.
Pretty much. I will say this, though. Look, I can make fun of the 8-bit of it all. About the silly naming conventions, about the ridiculous platform spawning, the insta-death. The level design is never particularly inventive. The platforming, such as it is serviceable at best. And the action is indeed rendered a little bit more staid and measured and stately of a pace by virtue of the stamina bar. But I was liking these nice, big, colorful 8-bit sprites.
Mm-hmm.
I think visually, Astyanax looks a lot better than a lot of contemporaries. Like, for example, I was loading up the NES version of Bad Dudes because I was curious. Because I really like the arcade version of Bad Dudes. Because, Caitlin, rampant ninja-related violence these days. Are you a bad enough dude to rescue the president? These are important questions that need to be addressed. I love the Bad Dudes arcade game. But I always remember that even though a lot of people have enthusiasm for the Bad Dudes NES game, I find it to be an adaptation very much like how I described the Genesis adaptations of Golden Axe. A little bit too fast, a little bit too slippery, a little bit too janky. And sure enough, that was true. And Bad Dudes, compared to Astyanax, you could tell me that they were on different generations of console and I would believe you, frankly. Because it's not the best looking NES game ever, but Astyanax has these large, very colorful sprites, not a whole lot of flicker going on.
Yeah.
And I was in the right kind of mood, loading up AstyNX on those few days over the course of the past week to just walk from left to right and hit things.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah. And it's pretty satisfying.
Yeah, you hit stuff and they get knocked back. I mean, if they're a air enemy and they take multiple hits or, you know.
And short of the platform spawn nonsense and when I remembered to just pause at the lip of every pillar just to see if the next pillar was going to spawn some sort of weird plant that was going to kill me automatically, I thought that it was reasonably well done and not terribly, terribly janky. I thought the boss fights were pretty okay. As far as such things go, their patterns were pretty perceptible and I could start dodging around and avoiding their attacks and knowing when to attack them when my attack bar was full. I was pleasantly surprised by AstyNX, frankly.
Yeah, I thought that it held up much more than I expected. I was, yeah, still very frustrated by the stupid platform spawns. But, I mean, it was one of my favorite games when I was a kid, so there's definitely some nostalgia going on. The music, I thought, was pretty fun to listen to.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of nostalgia there, too, but it was like, man, this music goes hard.
I found it a little annoying. Only in the way that a lot of 8-bit music does, but I found it
a little
annoying.
Sure, sure. And I enjoyed the story, too. Like, I did play through the whole thing. I did not do it in a legit way. I did save states because, you know, I wanted to be able to actually beat it in a reasonable amount of time.
Entirely fair.
Yeah, it was good.
And I gotta say, just to return, the storytelling isn't terrible. By the standards of 8-bit Nintendo games, it's quite excellent. And by modern standards, it's very much, oh, I'm surprised they decided to spend this much time and effort on it.
Yeah. I mean, even just seeing, like, they weren't all still images, you know? The fairy would be flapping her wings, and it's like, oh, there's animation here. That's cool.
Again, big sprites, big pictures, filling the screen. It was wonderful. And I'll say it just so you don't have to, Caitlin. I think AstyNX looked pretty dreamy.
Yes, he was another subject of my childhood crush.
I can see why.
Yeah.
Strapping looking lad. Have you played the arcade version? I shouldn't say version. Have you played the arcade game with the same name?
I have not.
I do not recommend it.
Okay. In that case, maybe I won't look for it.
Not at all similar, frankly.
Okay.
So that's AstyNX. I don't think it's going to be making anyone's top 10 hidden gems lists of NES games, but I found it an enjoyable romp nonetheless. Let us take a brief break to hear from our sponsors.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
And we're back.
All right. So we're going to move on to our feature game, The Friends of Ringo Ishikawa. It was released in 2018 and developed and published by
Yeo.
Yeah. So, if I'm being honest, I still don't really know what to think of this one.
Well, look, it's a crowded genre, right? It's yet another pixel art existentialist life sim brawler. Again.
It really doesn't handhold you at all. You have, like, this very light tutorial kind of thing at the beginning.
Woof. I'm amazed they, like, even bothered with that much.
I know. It's like, okay, here's some basics of the beat-em-up bits. Also, like, your one of your teachers is like, hey, you're smart and you should do better in school. Do better in school, okay? And then you get to do whatever you want. And you don't know where anything is because there's no map. You just have to kind of figure things out, or you look up a Steam guide, which is eventually what I did when I was like, I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm frustrated by not knowing what I'm doing.
Oh yeah, I totally looked up a guide as well. Went to good old GameFAQs.
Yes.
had some good old descriptions there. So let us imagine a spectrum, Caitlin.
Yes.
On one end of the spectrum, let us put things like the more recent Persona games and the more recent Red Dead Redemption games, where 20, 30 hours in, that's not too late for another 5-minute tutorial. We can put in another bunch of tutorials there. That's fine. we can explain the same things five times over to you. Let's put Pokemon Ranger in there too.
Sure.
Just in terms of the over-explaining thing, right? Pokemon Ranger would gladly spend five sentences to explain something that could easily be understood in two words. And then on the other end of the spectrum, I think we have a new other end of the poll.
Yeah.
Which is the friends of Ringo Ishikawa. Where are his parents? That may or may not come up. Where's the school? Oh, you'll find it eventually or you won't. What? You'll get it or you won't. Am I sort of... Stop asking questions. And I agree with you. It's very daunting.
Yeah, I was starving for a while. I thought I was going to die. It turns out you don't actually need to eat in order to live, which is something, yeah. I guess.
Found that out by accident, too, because I just ran out of money.
Yeah, ran out of money. I was like, how do I get money? I don't understand. So I did find that the tips that I read in a handful of the guides that I looked up were extremely helpful in just giving me my bearings. There's a lot of stuff to do, but it's very difficult to figure out how to do a decent amount of it until you know that it exists. Because you can go work out at the playground. But I didn't know I could work out at the playground. Or when I did and I just got some hit points, I tried again and then I didn't get hit points. And I was like, oh, okay. But there's actually like this whole thing of how you can work out and you get progressively stronger if you work out. Like every time you work out and you'll be able to do more and more pull-ups or whatever the other thing is that aren't pull-ups, eventually you get more and more hit points for doing that same task, which is cool, but I never would have figured that out in a million years by myself, right? Like, you can go to class because you have classes and they're at 9 a.m. and 12 p.m. Monday through Friday. And you can kind of guess, like, yes, there's school Monday through Friday, but I didn't know which classroom was mine. Had to figure that out as well, because there's three levels of the school, or three levels with rooms at the school, and your classroom is only, you know, two of those doors. You can take your exams, which are every Saturday. You can read books in the library. And if you're unlucky, like I was, the first few books, Ringo will just be like, oh, that wasn't that interesting. But apparently, there's permanent skills you can learn by reading those library books.
Yep. Random every time.
Yeah. And if you could buy books and you can read them in benches or restaurants, and I think that affects some story stuff maybe, or at least character stuff. You can write research papers, you can study at home, which I could not figure, like I didn't know how to do that for the longest time. I would just go up to the desk and it would show me a bunch of like my percentage of learning in each subject. And I was like, okay, what's the point of this? But apparently there's a button you can hit, which at least on the controller, I think was like R1. Which will actually cause you to study and you can get more like percentage progress, I guess, in your study. So that's cool. But anyway, training and boxing. You can work at the video store to get money. But by the way, it's during the school day, so good luck with that. And you can beat people up, of course. That's like the main... I mean, that's the only thing you were given a tutorial on. I'm sure I missed stuff, but yeah.
Oh, no, there's tons you've missed. And
yeah, there's so much stuff.
There's so much that one could do in the Friends of Ringo Ishikawa, and the game is utterly uninterested in letting you know about the existence of any of it. I'm not saying that it should tell me the metrics behind which pull-ups increase your hit points. Leave that math ambiguous. Fine. Yeah. Cool. No problem. You don't even have to tell me that after being able to do a certain number of pull-ups, I can show up at the gym and suddenly the teacher, who may or may not practice either karate or judo, but they use them interchangeably, which is very confusing because the rest of the Friends of Ringo Ishikawa expect you to know a great deal about Japanese culture, including that because he's a third year, of course Ringo's classroom is on the third floor of his school. How could you not know that?
Obviously.
You haven't been watching enough anime, Caitlin. Obviously. But at the same time, they're going to use karate and judo interchangeably, which is bizarre. Anyway, and then you can go train and learn new throws. So there's this pipeline from pull-ups to hit points to new throw techniques. Fine, you don't need to tell me that. You could at least give me some kind of overall structure to let me know about the existence of these things.
Like, right.
You can do it organically. Again, I respect the fact that it's not going to give me these forced tutorial segments that I can't skip, because Persona 5 Royal is one of my favorite games of all time. Did I find the tutorial segments patronizing and overlong? Absolutely, 100%. You don't need to have one of the eponymous friends of Ringo Ishikawa being like, Ringo, let's go do some pull-ups. Ooh, I do pull-ups by holding X. Ah, maybe someday I'll get to do 10 pull-ups. Then maybe, okay, fine. Yeah. I respect that. Maybe at some point somebody could say, oh, like, Goro, where were you, Goro? It's like, oh, I was at that place behind the yard. I was working on my pull-ups because I want to get buff. Yeah, something like that. I mean, look, work on the writing. We could workshop it, right? But like...
yeah.
Something, anything. Like, what proportion of people actually stumble through this? And like, there's a very specific question. What proportion of people stumble through this, don't make use of a reference, figure out how this stuff works, and appreciate having had to learn it that way? I don't know how many people. Maybe the designer's one of them. Because this is such a bizarre cultural artifact. Like, I, like you, am very confused about how I feel about it. Other than to say, I don't know how much more I want to play of it. I really don't. I don't even know how much of it I enjoyed playing. And I have some more specific criticisms later.
Yeah.
I'm so glad it exists.
Yeah, me too. Like, despite not knowing at all what I actually feel, if guides did not exist, I absolutely would have quit already. Just because, I don't know,
fatigue. Oh, really?
But... because I was able to learn about some of the stuff to do, I actually can figure out what I'm supposed to do during the day. Like, I'm enjoying it enough. Enjoying is a tough word. I don't know. I'm getting through it enough that I will likely attempt to complete it. Because I am interested in seeing where it goes, but it's wild. I don't know.
So I don't have a huge amount of enthusiasm for the particular subgenre of story this is.
Yeah.
Which is to say, delinquent coming of age. There's a whole like subsection of anime and manga that talk about high school hoodlums, more or less. And I don't find their stories especially interesting. But it is conceivable that the arty response, Caitlin, to your overall categorization of your enthusiasm or lack thereof to the friends of Ringo Ishikawa might actually be, just to emphasize how incredibly arty this is in a lot of ways, is maybe you're not supposed to enjoy it.
Yeah.
Because a non-trivial amount, and this is where the genius starts coming in, the non-trivial amount of the friends of Ringo Ishikawa is about how coming of age sucks and graduating high school blows and having to figure out what you're supposed to do with yourself is ass. There are all these conversations that Ringo has either with other adults or other people his own age where they're like, well, what's going to happen next? And it's like, oh, awful. And that's kind of the point of the game insofar as there is a point, I guess. I don't know. Trying to say that there's a point to the friends of Ringo Ishikawa feels like doing it a disservice, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But insofar as I was able to glean an overall theme, it is that growing up is awful.
Yeah, it's funny because I feel like the friends of Ringo Ishikawa has structure that's not dissimilar to cozy games. This is not a cozy game.
Mm,
but
yeah.
The kind of the openness to do whatever you want to do.
Totally.
And I couldn't stop thinking about that while also being like, oh my God, there's so much and I don't know what to do. And I got fired from my video game store, or not video game, my video store job.
Video rental store job, yeah.
Caitlin,
yeah. If I had a video rental store, I would hire you for that position.
Thank you.
I wouldn't hire Ringo Ishikawa though, that's for damn sure. Yeah, it's weird. The sense of opportunity cost can be crippling and anxiety-inducing, frankly. And I think part of the problem is, and this is one of my substantive criticisms, this is something I absolutely would have changed, does the clock really need to be ticking down while you're going from place to place? I don't think so. I think they could have easily made it so that the day timer was only active when you were doing something, instead of just wandering around lost. And so... It made me feel this internalized sense of pressure. And so I would always just revert back to the things I knew how to do. So for a long stretch of the Friends of Ringo Ishikawa, all I would do is I would go to school and study at home. And that it's weird. That's kind of okay. Like, I'm sure the really arty appreciator of Friends of Ringo Ishikawa. And by the way, I'm using arty here not as a pejorative. I'm using it as somebody who is able to appreciate the art form slightly more than I am. And they would say, yeah, that's a perfectly legitimate, there you go, that's your Ringo Ishikawa, that's his third year for you. But it's like, you set up Ringo with an intro segment and with a lot of dialogue, and straight-A student who does nothing but study ain't it. Right? Yeah. So it's not even just that it's clashing with the way he's presented originally. It's not even just that he's clashing with the way he's lived the previous 14, 15 years of his life. He has dialogues with his friends where he doesn't sound or act like somebody who does nothing but study.
Yeah.
And this is represented, I think, most pointedly in one gameplay element. If you show up to school, which admittedly is optional, but it's one of the best ways to get money, for what it's worth, if you know to show up in the faculty office at the end of the week, which the game doesn't tell you. You're sitting there, and the lesson is presented as though there's this lesson. The teacher's yammering at the front of the class, and you can either hold down the study button, in which case Ringo takes studious notes.
Yep.
Or you don't, in which case he'll look out the window or just slack off and do various delinquent slouching stuff. And in real life, and in other forms of fiction, and in almost any other medium, this could be part of Ringo's challenges, a struggle. There's a trade-off involved. It's hard to pay attention.
Yeah.
In the context of a video game, it's trivial. And of course you hold down the button, because when you hold down the button, number go up. If you don't hold down the button, number no go up. Number no go up bad. Number go up good. You hold down button. And so this is one of those areas where the medium and the message are fighting with each other, right? And so that's one of the reasons why I felt like I was being pushed into making Ringo Ishikawa a straight-A student, whether I wanted the story to go that way or not. And that, I think, is one of those indications of how, as a piece of art, Ringo has aspirations that it can't quite execute. Does that make sense?
I'm completely with you there. It felt a little strange to be playing the friends of Ringo Ishikawa, because I feel like the Ringo that I was playing was a completely different person from the Ringo who existed until I started playing the game. And
yeah,
when I'm done playing the game, I have no idea how it ends or whatever, but I imagine that the Ringo that exists afterward is going to be very different from the Ringo that I played. Like, it's...
I hate to break it to you, Caitlin. There is no Ringo when you're not playing Ringo.
His grades are all Fs when you start. And if you just go to class every day and study a little bit at home, it's not that hard to just get straight A's. But obviously, that's not what he was doing.
And in the classroom, you see all his friends slacking off or like taking intermittent notes or what have you. Some of his friends, the ones that are in his own class. And again, I'm like, yeah, it's hard. I remember high school. I remember even university when I was there voluntarily. It's hard to pay attention and keep studious notes.
Mm-hmm.
But when Mark is controlling Ringo, it's trivial.
Yeah, you hold down that button and you're good.
I'm confident, or at least I'm hopeful. I could be completely wrong. I'm not a game designer. I'm not even particularly artistically inclined. I can appreciate that Ringo genuinely approaches art at times.
Mm-hmm.
I think Ringo could still have been art with Ringo knowing where the playground was. You know, and how you institute that, I don't know. Maybe it's a mini map. Maybe it's something you open up. Maybe it's a series of notes somewhere. Maybe it's some sort of subtle tutorializing. I don't know. But one thing's for sure. When I see that timer in the upper right hand ticking up in increments of 10 minutes, because I vaguely remember that there's a mechanic somewhere in town, but I can't really remember what series of turns to get there, and I'm just wandering around lost.
Yep.
I don't know if that's part of the artistic message or not, but I don't want it in my game.
Yeah, it's stressful. And then, you know, you finally decide to engage in a fight because that's what you start the game doing. And
yeah, let's talk about the brawling, yeah.
Yeah. There's obviously different levels of enemies. There's some enemies that only hit me for 9 hit points and other ones that hit me for upwards of 30.
Yeah.
I assume that's maybe based on their the color of their uniforms, but I don't know. And I didn't figure out which ones I should be engaging with and which ones I should be running away from.
You generally don't know until you start a fight.
Yeah. I guess that's like real life.
Yeah. I mean, for what it's worth, the lesson that I learned, which is a reasonably good lesson, is don't start a fight when you're on your own.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You will get put to the ground real fast.
Just asking for trouble. I just got in the habit of partying up with my dudes. Like, you see somebody hanging outside the front of the school and it's like, hey, why don't you chill out with me? What you get to do is follow me around and wait while I do pull-ups, and then I might start a fight, And then if the fight's going badly, I'm going to just leave you behind. Is that cool? And they all say, yeah, yeah, that's cool. And then they go follow me around. I loved that brawling was like the key non-life sim game element. Mm-hmm. I wasn't so much in love with how the brawling actually worked. Like I've been saying all episode, hit detection matters a lot. How satisfying and how substantial it feels to make contact with someone matters a great deal. And there Ringo doesn't quite measure up. It feels a little bit loose, a little bit sloppy. It wasn't particularly satisfying. I did love throwing people to the ground, though.
Yes.
Oh my goodness. The lavish animation of the various forms of judo throw were endlessly amusing.
Yes.
Even though it's not the most effective fighting technique, broadly speaking. Like, a lot of love went into every element of the Friends of Rinjiro Ishikawa, and the number of frames of animation lavished into some of those attacks is clear. Even though sometimes the graphics look very janky. Again, the aforementioned pull-ups, when Rinko's doing a pull-up, it's like the most absurd cartoon noodly arms. It's so silly looking, and it's miles away from how expertly his like jump kicks are animated, for example.
Yeah, and every time, I noticed that every time Ringo is looking up, so like if you stand at your locker, it looks like he might be peeing. Like, you can't see his arms, they're in front of him. And I just have to assume that every time you're doing that, he's just peeing on something. He's peeing on his locker, like, I don't know.
I didn't necessarily make that inference, but sure. I did love that there was a button whose sole purpose was to have him walk like a delinquent.
Yes.
Like, you can walk normally. You can run, or you can hold down the delinquent button, and then he slouches and puts his hands in his pockets and just starts sauntering along. This is in conjunction with the strangely in-depth cigarette smoking mechanisms.
Yes. I kept hitting that button by accident, so I would, like, light a cigarette, throw it away. Light a cigarette, throw it away.
Maybe that was Ringo trying to quit.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I ran out and I haven't bought any new ones, so now he just flips a coin, which is okay by me.
Oh, you gotta buy Ringo some new smokes. How is he gonna be a classic delinquent if he doesn't have any cigarettes?
I just don't know. I don't know how he's gonna make it.
Well, I guess that's a good way to sum it up, right? Yeah, I agree with you. I am so happy that Friends of Ringo Ishikawa exists. I have no regrets about purchasing a game like this. Even though I'm usually a huge cheapskate when it comes to things outside of Game Pass, I am really happy that there are independent creators, and this was from Russia, by the way, that want to make things like this. I am not exactly sure how I feel about all of my gameplay experiences in Ringo Ishikawa, and I'm not exactly sure if I'm along for the rest of the ride, but all told, this is a truly unique piece of culture, and I'm very impressed by it in a number of ways.
Same. Also, I would highly recommend that people check out, I think it's on The Verge, there is a interview with the developer, and I thought it was very fascinating. So highly recommend checking it out if you're interested in the game at all.
I will leave a link in the episode notes below, absolutely. All right, so that was the Friends of Ringo Ishikawa. We will now move on to some shameless hyping of upcoming titles, what we call Shout. Caitlin, what would you like to shout out for us?
So today, I'm going to shout out Paralives. I very recently learned about this. It is a Sims game, except it's not The Sims. It's something else. Because I was just thinking to myself, hearing about how buggy, how ridiculously buggy, you know, The Sims 4 is. I mean, it's fun. I love those things. But I've always kind of wondered, like, why hasn't anyone else done it? Partly maybe the scope. I don't know. But anyway, Paralives is something that is supposedly coming out sometime this year. And it looks neat. The art style is kind of like, you know, flat, cel-shaded. It looks cool. There's also one called Inzoi, which looks like you probably can't run it if you have the computer of a mere mortal. But both of those are kind of like similar to The Sims, and I'm looking forward to seeing what happens with them when they theoretically come out this year. I think Inzoi is early access this year. The other one is releasing this year, allegedly. So we'll see.
I've been seeing endless tech articles about Inzoi, and yeah, it's definitely making the rounds. I do appreciate the first line of the description of Paralives in Steam. It definitely knows what it's getting into. You live and then you die, but at least do it in a nice house.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's good to acknowledge that The Sims and related games have always been about blatant and relentless consumerism.
Yes.
No shade. Just, it is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, what are you looking forward to?
I would like to shout out something that is currently on Game Pass Early Access. It is their equivalent of Early Access. It is a game preview. It's called 33 Immortals. Mm. This is by Thunder Lotus. This is very much exploring the kind of same genre in a way that Rabbit and Steel was, which is to say the pickup raid. So in 33 Immortals, what you do is it's a combat roguelite, but you're just paired up with a whole bunch of other people and you go do a raid-like thing. And I'm, you know, the actual moment-to-moment gameplay is very, very different from that of Rabbit and Steel, but it's nonetheless structurally something that I think is an interesting design space. I've not yet played 33 Immortals. You can play it, but again, it's not a real game yet. I don't want to get too excited about something until it's finished. But it is going to be on Game Pass when it's done, and it's already getting some early good coverage. I'm very curious to see how it develops. 33 Immortals.
Yeah, I also just heard about that recently. I saw it's on Game Pass. I'm intrigued. It looks super cool. I really like the idea, so I hope that they execute on it well.
Well, on that note of optimism, we are going to close it out for this episode of All My Best Friends Are Digital. Thank you so much for deciding to spend some time with us. If you're at all interested in supporting what we do and supporting free and independent media, you can find us on patreon.com/ambfad. But no matter what, we hope to see you again soon.
Thanks, everybody. Have a good week.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in touch, you can reach us at allmybestfriendsaredigital@gmail.com. Hope to see you again soon.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.